This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Said there are economists who think that it's all about science. I don't think economics is a science. I think economics tries to explain why people do what they do, and it's very, very difficult. And perhaps economists need to be a little bit more humble about their predictive capacity. So I'm not an economist who thinks it is basically a science. But I'm going to make 5 points in the time I've got allowed to be. The first point, really, is the myth of TINA. Many of you will be aware of what TINA stands for. TINA is an acronym. It stands for There Is No Alternative. This is an argument now that we have commonly in the economic refrain, that basically we've only got plan A. Plan A is the only policy that will actually work. Well, all the lessons of economic history show that there are many different ways you can run an economy. There's always plan B, C, D, and E. And often those who just focus on plan A find out that plan A fails. Lessons of history show that often plan A fails. We need to look at alternatives in terms of economic policy. If we take the current conventional wisdom, the plan A, what I've called here the new Treasury view, and I'll tell you why it's the new Treasury view in a minute, there's a commitment to balance budgets, and the argument, I would argue, they've got no coherent growth strategy. The strategy is just about fiscal retrenchment and not about policy for long-term growth. The simple argument is the focus is on deficit reduction, and that will deliver growth. Now, I'd argue if you look at economic history, there's no case where that's appeared. No modern case in economic history where that's actually worked. People argue Canada's a case, but Canada's not a case where this actually worked. Canada's a case where the economy is growing very rapidly through export-led growth. It doesn't work historically. If we look at what the current Chancellor is saying, very much along these lines, he says, you will hear those arguing that we should abandon our plan and spend and borrow away out of debt. You hear that argument again today. A credible plan to deal with our debts is an anchor of stability and a prerequisite of recovery. The argument is deficit reduction will generate economic growth. Now, perhaps this Chancellor should learn from other Chancellors. I won't refer here in this case to Lord Lamont. If we look at actually this case, we look to Winston Churchill. Because Winston Churchill was the architect of the first Treasury view, the original Treasury view in the 1920s. The original Treasury view said, the Treasury view is that when the government borrows in the money market, it becomes a new competitor with industry and engrosses to itself resources which would otherwise have been employed by private enterprise. And the process raises the rent of money to all those who have need of it. Basically, a very similar argument. If government borrows money, then the interest rate goes up and that deters private sector investment. Now, what that led to in the 1920s was discontent, unemployment, and industrial unrest. It led to very slow economic growth in the 1920s. It helped to actually exacerbate the Great Depression by governments having fiscal retrenchment and monetary retrenchment when the economy was going into slump. There were many critics of Churchill at the time, and Keynes was one of them. Keynes said, referring to Churchill here, why did he do such a silly thing? Partly perhaps he had no instinctive judgment to prevent him from making mistakes. Partly because lacking this instinctive judgment, he was deafened by the clamorous voices of conventional finance. And most of all, because he was gravely misled by his experts. Keynes was very scathing about those sorts of problems. And actually, what actually happened was that Plan A was discarded. Plan A was discarded in 1931. We had a new policy. We had policies of lower interest rates. It was called cheap money. We had a lower exchange rate to make exports competitive. We had protectionism. And we had fiscal expansion later on in the 1930s. And that led to rapid economic growth. We'll come back to that in a minute. The basically what the response was of many politicians. They said, nobody told us we could do that. The conventional wisdom, plan A had to exist. There was no other options. Then no other options were implemented, and we had an economic growth, an economic revival. There are always alternatives. They may be good or bad, but they need to be debated more robustly. This, basically, the argument I would put forward is if you growth is a way to get rid of deficit reduction. The causality comes from a growing economy. That will get your deficit down. If you've got a growing economy, more people pay taxes, less people claim unemployment benefit. The fiscal stabilizers kick in, and basically the way to get the deficit down is to get the economy growing. The first priority should be growth, and that will solve the deficit reduction problem. Point two I want to make is the argument about the Greek veil that's actually covering economic policy at the moment. This is the argument that, of course, we cannot have any fiscal expansion because we will turn into Greece. We will turn into Greece, and that will be economic, political, industrial collapse. So there's no way we can have an expansion because of the threat of turning the British economy to the Greek economy. Now, of course, the British economy is very different to the Greek economy. It's a different economic structure. We have a different, and of course, Greece is hampered by being in the euro, which means it has very little flexibility over its economic policy. Greece has a problem of raising tax revenue. Would it be feasible that if we had a more expansionist growth strategy, we would turn into Greece? I would argue not. So let's look at long-term interest rates here. There's Greece at the top, and there's the UK at the bottom. Is it feasible that if we have an expansionary policy, our interest rates are going to increase that rate? I would argue no, it's not. It may well be that the markets do respond negatively in some response to a growth strategy, but they certainly not going to turn us into Greece in terms of Greek interest rates. And actually, in many cases, the markets may actually like a growth strategy because it will actually help to solve the deficit in the long run. I'd argue the argument that we've seen both in the UK and during the US election that expansionary fiscal policy will turn these countries into Greece are mistaken. Also, and part of this story is debt is so historically high we have to get it down. Debt is so historically high, it has to get down, it has to be the priority. Public sector debt is at record levels. But it depends what your sense of history is. This is UK national debt from 1900 to 2010. Debt levels were much higher in the interwar period, much higher after the Second World War into the 50s and 60s. We tend to focus on this, but yes, it's gone up, and that's an issue of concern, and we can debate about how we decrease it. But basically, if you take a long-run view, and I'm an economic historian, as you may detect in some respects, if you take a long-run view, the debt levels are not historically high. And with very low interest rates, they're very, very easily fundable, particularly in the short to medium run. Third point. Governments do not generate growth, the private sector does. Okay, this is actually a quote from the Sunday Times, but it's common in the refrain. Okay, the governments and the state harm the economy, we need to decrease the size of the economy, but the private sector actually generates economic growth. So the public sector hampers growth, the private sector generates economic growth. This doesn't fit any notion of how you look at the national income accounts, and it doesn't fit any notion about how you look at what drives long-term economic growth. If we look at the private sector, of course it generates economic growth. If you look at our GDP statistics, yes, more lawyers would generate economic growth. More hairdressing, more investment banking even, more footballing and more flipping burgers will actually generate economic growth. Yes, the private sector does generate economic growth and add to GDP, but so does the public sector. The public sector adds to GDP. The public sector through education, health, defence and so on, they all add to GDP. Now we can discuss about how we fund it and the composition of it, but basically GDP is generated by both private sector and public sector activity. If we look at the size of the state, it's increased in every single advanced country since 1960 to 2007. The size of government has been getting bigger. Now, many would argue that's an adverse effect. It's somehow to do with the rise of corporatism, the rise of the state. But there's a sound economic reason why the size of the state has got bigger. What do we want as we are richer, as citizens and as households? We want more stuff. We want to buy more stuff. But particularly what we want is more education for ourselves and our children. You being here, by many definitions, is by having you're paying for education. We want more health for ourselves and our children. Education, put it bluntly, if you're going to economic terminology, economic and health
have high income elasticities. As we get richer, we want more of it. And the state provides a lot of education and health. It's a sound economic reason. If we look at the big chunks of UK government spending, it's health, education, and social protection. And in there, the biggest chunk is pensions. That's the downside of living longer. Well, actually, it's quite good that we live longer, but we have to pay for it. Okay, so the idea, argument, is that the state has a very important contribution to GDP for providing education and health. If we want to decrease the size of the state, we have to think about who's going to pay for more education and health in the future, or are we going to decrease social protection from those who may be more disadvantaged than the average in society? The other point to mention about the role of the state is about innovation and technology. Long-term growth comes from not just employing more resources, which is a problem, but using those more resources more effectively. How do we generate more long-term growth? Well, we think it's all about innovation and technology, and often the argument is about entrepreneurship and venture capital, and they're very important parts of the innovation system. But so is the state. So is the state because innovation is highly expensive, very uncertain, and takes a long time. Private markets don't do long-term innovation very well. This is a quote from Mariana Mazzucato, who wrote a book, The Entrepreneurial State, which you can download free if you so wish. She said, how many people know that the algorithm that led to Google's success was funded by a public sector National Science Foundation grant? Or the molecular antibodies, which provided the foundation for biotechnology before venture capital moved into the sector, were discovered in the public medical research council labs. Very much the public sector is a very important contributor to long-term growth. The private sector and enterprise is very crucial in the American economy. So is the state by investing in long-term technology. Fourth point, the need for bold policies and not just bold appointments. We need a change, getting back to our, we need more Plan B or Plan C. It's certainly the case that bold appointments may have a beneficial effect. But the new governor of the Bank of England has had an important role in the Canadian revival, but the most important part was Canadian policies, not Canadian individuals. It was the Canadian policy regime that was crucial for generating some degree of resistance to the power of the forces of austerity in the Canadian economy. What would be the ways forward? Well, we have a long and detailed discussion about this, but I'm just going to mention 3 points. Firstly, a return to active demand management. Governments need to regulate the economy in terms of output employment and not just in terms of inflation targeting. Yep, Keynesianism. Secondly, we need to develop new forms of regulation, particularly in financial markets. As we well know, financial markets were effectively turning into a casino, and that really harmed both the British economy but also the world economy. And again, Keynes, I think, got this right. When Keynes said, when the capital development of a country becomes a byproduct of a casino, the job is likely to be ill done. Thirdly, we need to have, and this picks up on, I think, what Linda was saying earlier, we need to invest in more infrastructure, we need to invest in new ideas. We need to invest in the ideas that will generate growth not next year, but in 10, 15, and 20 years' time. Investment in ideas and technology are crucial. The unfortunate thing here is if we look at the UK's evidence, this shows government budget outlays on research and development as one measure, weighted by size of country. 2007 is the index of 100. There's one of these major six economies that's investing less in research and development in 2010 than it was in 2007, and that's the UK. Many other countries have responded to the impact of austerity and recession by investing in R&D and investing in new ideas. Unfortunately, the UK, certainly up until tomorrow, is investing less in R&D and technology than many other economies. Fifth point. Gets back to what we're here for. What we're here for is by looking about what's going to go on in the future. What's the forecast for the next year? Well, forecast is guesswork, particularly economic forecasting, particularly quarterly economic forecasting. My view here really is the long-term prognosis is dismal, and actually the short-term prognosis isn't much better either until we have a major change in economic strategy. Let's look at the power of economic forecasting. I don't have the resources of Bloomberg. I just have my own views on this, but let's think about what the Bank of England does. Okay, the Bank of England employs lots of economists, actually a few of which I've actually educated. But many economists in the Bank of England, what do they say is going to go on? This is the Bank of England forecast, the latest one for November 2012. This is the dreaded fan diagram. green shows the area of uncertainty. So this is the big recession. This is the double dip recession that it was referring to. You see that we've got uncertainty about the future, and actually we've got some uncertainty about the past. But the idea is we're going to return to normal, okay? We're going to return to economic growth. It's going to be normal. It's going to be growth around about 2.5% in the future. The model here, I might mention something about the model. The model that the Bank of England has the product of the model will always get you back to the equilibrium of the nature of the model. The model the Bank of England has no banks in it. No banks in an economic model. This is what it said in 2012. That's what it said in 2010. Yeah, we've got a big recession. Don't worry, no double dip, just return to normal. Okay, didn't get the double dip right. Let's go back to 2007. Look where the horizontal axis is. Okay, down here, we just have a return to normal. We're going to carry on at 2.5%, 3%. No notion of what's predicting the recession. No notion of predicting the double dip. And these are some of our most powerful economists in the country. The basic point here, I would argue, is that it's very difficult. Economic forecasting is very much, in the short term, very, very difficult. In the longer term, it's probably easier. In the short term, it's very difficult. But at the moment, what the Bank of England says is, don't worry, we'll return to normal. We'll return to normal, it said in 2007. We'll return to normal in 2010 after a major shock. We'll have a double dip, and we'll still return to normal. My basic point here is, no return to normal. There's going to be no return to normal unless we see a major change in economic policy in the future. I've had my time up. So what are the predictions? This isn't consensus forecasting. This is one person guessing. GDP, I think, is going to be pretty flat. Bear in mind, after a major recession, you'd expect growth to be 3 or 4% per annum because of bounce back. No bounce back. This is very slow. Around about 0% the first quarter, 0% in this quarter, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4. Very low performance. Inflation, again, echoing what Linda was saying, above the Bank of England's target rate. Unemployment going up. It's a lagging indicator, again, as Linda said, and also we have lots of underemployment, which we haven't got here. Unemployment's going to get worse. And, of course, interest rates are going to remain locked at 0.5%. If one thing I can forecast with a degree of prediction, I will pay £20 if it's wrong, is that Ethan says it's 0.5% for the next four quarters. Because that's what it's going to be. I'll get my money out now. And as far as the Greek bond yield, yes, 10%. 10% is the low. It's going to bounce around like an erratic fall for the next year. That's the low. The high is going to be much higher. And unlike Linda, I think Greece will be outside the euro within 12 months' time. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Violent assault on Tina. Poor Tina, she's had it. Actually, what was interesting was having the forecast for GDP growth of the first two contestants or the first two presenters have been extraordinarily similar. We now come on to Professor Ita Mielzetsky, who is a lecturer in the Department of Economics and associate at the Center of Economic Performance at the LSE. His research focuses on macroeconomics and fiscal policy, with a particular interest in macroeconomic policy in developing countries. He's held policy and research positions at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the US Department of the Treasury, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation. We look forward very much to your presentation. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the invitation. I, too, do not view myself as a titan, so I, too, will somewhat throw away the script, just as Michael did. And I'm going to actually talk about something related to the U.S. economy as opposed to the U.K. economy. And there are two reasons for this. One is that it's an economy I know more about. And the second reason is that I actually think that a lot of the factors that will influence the growth prospect of the U.K. economy are outside of borders of the UK and also outside of the control of the UK. So in a sense, I might differ a little bit from Michael. I agree with most of the policy recommendations, in fact. But I think those things will affect the UK's economy on the margin. biggest uncertainty in all our predictions will not be from domestic factors, which I think we know for good or for bad what they're going to look like for the upcoming year. For the most part, I think most of the uncertainties, the biggest reasons any of us will be wrong with our predictions, are going to come from external factors. That's my prediction. So I'll give you some context of what's going on in the United States right now. So this is a very similar figure to what was just shown for the UK. This is the debt of the U.S. federal government, and debt is unprecedentedly high in the post-war period. It's true that if we extended this back to the Second World War, we'd get a very similar picture as in the UK. So this is by no means unprecedented levels of debt in the long view of history, but definitely in the post-war period, these are unprecedented levels of debt. There are different measures of how U.S. debt is measured, but by any measure, debt is elevated relative to where it's been in the past 50 years. Now, much of this debt has been a result of the financial crisis. I too agree that it is economic growth that drives deficits more than the other way around, and therefore a large economic crisis causes a loss of revenues and causes spending to automatically increase, such as unemployment payments. And that, most of that increase you see at the end of the graph is really because of the financial crisis. And most of the factors that cause debt to increase were beyond the control of economic policymakers in the United States. By the way, I think these exact same factors that are out of control of policymakers are central to the reason that the UK Treasury has been missing its fiscal targets consistently over the past couple of years. A lot of the evolution of debt is just an endogenous response to the state of the economy as opposed to some calculated policy decision. But we do see in the United States that there is an endemic problem, not only a recent problem. There is beyond the recent crisis, beyond the growth you see in the recent crisis, you'll notice that the trend has been upward for the past 40 years in the United States. And so there is the secular increase in the indebtedness of the United States, and there are also future challenges such as a social security system and a health system that is not funded entirely. And as the baby boomers retire, this is going to become a bigger and bigger fiscal challenge for the United States. Now, crises often provide a cover for policymakers to make difficult decisions, and this crisis was not an exception. So policymakers in the U.S. have been attempting to address these rising debts. But I'm going to argue that U.S. policymakers have bungled this so terribly that the attempts to address the debt have been far worse than anything the debt itself could have caused. So first I'd like to point out the problem, and I agree with this, with what Michael was saying before, the problem is not as large as perhaps the consensus policymakers are trying to put forth. The red line you see there is the debt of the United States federal government, and the black line is the real interest rate, the rate at which the U.S. government can borrow. First of all, notice that the interest rate is at historical lows. There is very little relationship between the level of debt of the U.S. government at the rate at which it can borrow. So there's no sign that when debt is high, the U.S. has greater difficulty in borrowing. And not only that, the interest rate was highest. The U.S. had the hardest time borrowing when debt was at below 40% of GDP before this large debt accumulation. So there's no indication that the U.S. government has any difficulty borrowing, and its ability to borrow has nothing to do with its level of indebtedness. That's one factor I want to point out, that the debt problem that scurrying around to try to resolve is not as big a problem as perhaps is popularly conceived. But I think policy should be precautionary. I think it's good that policymakers are trying to address future fiscal risks. But let's see how policymakers in the U.S. have gone by doing this. Well, about a year into the Obama presidency, President Obama wanted to tackle this problem head on and appointed Republican former Congressman Alan Simpson and Democrat Erskine Bowles to a fiscal commission, which was to devise a plan to address the long-term debt challenges of the United States. This commission delivered a report at the end of 2010, and it was, like many reports, simply ignored both by the president and the opposition, either side blaming the other side for not accepting the recommendations in full, while not accepting the recommendations in full themselves. So President Obama did not endorse it. Vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan on the Republican side did not endorse it. And as well, the commission itself voted against its own recommendations. Actually, there was a majority for, but a supermajority of the commission was required to deliver the recommendations to Congress. In the summer of 2011, the policy blunders became far worse, and this is partially due to an obscure and outdated feature of U.S. fiscal policymaking, which requires the Congress not only to vote over a budget like any other legislature, but also to separately vote over the level of debt that the government is allowed to incur. Now, simple accounting would say that your budget, your taxes, and government spending imply a certain level of indebtedness. So you can't separately decide, I don't want to have a lot of debt, but I'd like to have low taxes and high public expenditures. That's precisely what the Congress has consistently done over the past decades, voted for low debt and high expenditures and low taxes, which is simply mathematically inconsistent. Usually, this was a pro forma matter. The Congress would just come along and just say, oh, we were just kidding. Let's raise the debt ceiling. That was just, we decided that 2 years ago, but we weren't really serious about that. In the summer of 2011, matters became serious when the debt ceiling was actually approached and hit, and there was a threat of the U.S. government being shut down. And Republican Congress said they would not raise the debt ceiling unless significant public spending cuts occurred. These sides eventually, the President and Congress, agreed to disagree and lifted the debt ceiling temporarily while agreeing, in order to show that they are serious about deficit reduction, to significant public spending cuts, draconian public spending cuts, to begin in January of 2013, the far future, the distant future. We'll never get to 2013, will we? These cuts were intentionally designed to be enormously draconian so that they push both sides to serious and negotiations in good faith as this date approached. But a month before that date, approximately 2 months before that date, was a presidential election, and to engage in such negotiations in the political season of the election was entirely impossible. So following Obama's re-election, the debt ceiling negotiations begun, and now we're only a month away of hitting what has now been dubbed the fiscal cliff, meaning that these automatic spending cuts will hit in January of 2013. Now, a month, I should say, unlike perhaps the policy making in the UK, for the US Congress, a month to pass legislation is just lightning speed. It is unheard of for serious legislation, or almost unheard of for serious legislation and well-thought-out legislation to pass within a month in the United States. So we are now facing enormous uncertainty as to what will happen in the upcoming month. I should also say at the end of this timeline that, of course, the debt ceiling was only temporarily raised, and it's forecast now that the debt ceiling will be hit again in February. So even after this fiscal cliff, even if these fiscal cliff negotiations are resolved, we're going to see this whole charade all over again in January as the debt negotiations on the debt ceiling begin again. So what is this fiscal cliff? In addition to the public spending cuts that I mentioned, the Bush tax cuts will expire in January, causing an increase of taxes of 2.7% of GDP. Together, this is a fiscal austerity plan that would not shame governments in Southern Europe, but not caused by any market need, not caused through serious policy planning, but rather through a political process that has become entirely dysfunctional. So I would still put a large probability on, you know, that Winston Churchill said that Americans always do the right thing after all other alternatives have been exhausted. And I think I would put odds in favor of this being yet another example of this, that at the last minute, at the 23rd hour, this will be all pulled back. But as Linda mentioned in her discussion, our colleague Nick Bloom and his co-authors created an index of policy uncertainty, and this uncertainty is now at highest levels since this index began being recorded, greater than following the Lehman Brothers collapse after 9/11. So this is there's an enormous degree of policy uncertainty in the U.S., which whose effects I think have already started to take place. So I'll skip to my prediction because I'm already out of time. I think that a lot of the effects of my predictions, except for Greece, are more optimistic, despite all I've said, than the other participants. The reason for this is that I do think that ultimately European crisis is on its way to being resolved. I do believe that the U.S. eventually will resolve its fiscal matters. And I do think that a lot of the behavior of markets is forward-looking. A lot of the problems we're seeing in the global economy right now are due to these expected calamities that are, I think, at the last moment we'll be able to avert. So I hope we're seeing the peak of unemployment coming up, and I think although unemployment is a lagging indicator, I do think we're going to see it coming down in 2013. Michael was right that there is not going to be a lot of discussion about what the Bank of England is going to do over the next year, at least in terms of interest rates. And I guess I'm the most pessimistic about Greece. I think basically the yield you see on Greek bonds right now is as good as it's going to get. Markets are optimistic. We haven't seen these low yields on Greek debt in the entire past year, so I've maybe shadowed the current price by about half a percentage point, but I think it's actually not going to get any better. I think anybody who thinks they're going to get 85% of their